是中国。
That's why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany.
Welcome to our China Coorg podcast. My name is Andreas Freitag, and I'm happy to welcome Dr. Greg Keske, who is a professor of economics at Citadel University in Charleston, South Carolina. Greg has got his PhD from George Mason, and he got his MA and BA from the University of Delaware. His expertise is on microeconomics and economic development with a political economy perspective, and he has worked extensively on China. And this is why we ask him to join us today. Thanks for coming and welcome, Greg.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Greg, Ed Bresser from the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, in a recent newsletter, predicted empty shelves for many goods of daily use for U.S. consumers in the near future. How realistic do you think this scenario is?
Well, if we take what Mr. Bresser said along with the president's recent remark that children should be happy with three dolls rather than 30 dolls, then that sounds like a quite serious possibility. But I think that the more realistic possibility is not empty shelves, but a more contracted choice set, right? So if you were going to go shopping for a quite specific pair of pants, well, maybe you'll certainly find pants or other linens or whatever on the shelves, but perhaps not in the sort of quality and quantity mix that you would have found prior to the so-called Liberation Day tariff regime implementation. So I believe that that's somewhat hyperbolic. And of course, there are substitutes. These things aren't, supply chains cannot be switched out overnight. That's what the president seems to believe. But I don't believe the possibility of empty shelves, although indeed a possibility, is a very likely one, but more of contracted choice, which is raising costs to consumers in another way.
But this brings me to a second question, and this is a serious one, namely rare earth. These essential commodities are important for U.S. high tech, and the Chinese government has announced to stop exporting them to the United States. Do you think this is a serious threat?
It indeed is a serious threat if it were to be followed through on. I believe the figure is about 70% of our rare earth minerals are imported from China. But I think the sort of perspective that I come at this, again, a sort of a political economy, public choice, I think of the CCP's goals as to maximize power. And a big part of that is maintaining stability and pleasing domestic interest group. Certainly large rare earth firms that are Chinese are powerful stakeholders within that country. So to cut off trade from the largest customer would certainly cause a lot of problems in a major industry within China. So while they can talk a really significant game, so to speak, on that, I assess the probability of following through as unlikely. And in a way, talking a big game and beating one's chest is, in a sense, providing some sort of benefits to the citizens within an authoritarian regime. It's sort of like a spiritual benefit or emotional of something, but that is a lower cost action compared to actually following through with it. And you see this sort of pattern with lots of topics, as Taiwan in particular comes to mind. So if it were to occur, it would be quite a devastating thing for the United States in the short run. But I assess the probability certainly of a full scale contraction of this trade as quite low. I wonder what you think.
Yes, I think you're right, but there's one counter argument to your reasoning is that, I mean, despite your correct and I think very appealing thoughts on the political economy of the Chinese government, they don't have to fear, at least in the short run, a democratic public, whereas President Trump seems to be very responsive to the latest polls that show that his approval rates are falling dramatically. So given that, I would at least see the danger that this is done for a while or in parts. So I'm not entirely optimistic that this part of the equation will not be realized, put it this way.
Yeah, it is and I indeed may be underestimating the possibility of it. Regardless, it appears like it is a gift served up on a platter to the regime in China, to the extent they can point to a boogeyman that's the cause of a problem that to some degree has internal origins. And you could say, well, it's external. It's the U.S. with their uncertain policies causing our contracted GDP growth on an annual basis. Then I think that's a big win for them in that sense. But indeed, we'll have to see what happens. But I still assess the probability is quite low. But the existence of other customers around the world certainly mitigates the costs of engaging in such a policy. So it's possible.
There are always outside options, and we will speak about that in a minute. But before that, I would like to hear your views on what the U.S. plans to do on Chinese vessels. It's a bombardment of numbers, $500 per container and something like that. Do you think that's a serious threat? And what will you make of it?
Yeah, it's very difficult to follow. Initially, and I think this has been backed off of, was a proposal of $1.5 million per port entry or something like that. But it seems like the more realistic or current sort of proposal is this per tonnage issue. And it looks like that's going to be implemented to the extent it's a problem. I mean, certainly Chinese firms dominate the global shipping industry. And the president has this rather zero-sum view of trade that, well, you know, to the extent their ships are pulling into our ports, that's an opportunity for our ships not to be doing this. There's many, many problems with this view. Of course, we basically don't have much by way of a fleet in this respect. I think we produce four or five of these vessels, nowhere near the size of what would be required for international trade. So to the extent it's a problem, it's a problem for me in terms of, you know, paying higher costs for consumer goods. It doesn't seem like a very significant problem for the Chinese in this respect, as they quite dominate. But we have a thing called the Jones Act in the United States, which is unfortunately not very well known. But basically, it says that to go from a U.S. port to another U.S. port, the ship has to be built in the U.S., manned by a 75% U.S. crew, and owned 75% by an American company. So basically, this is just a perfect rent-seeking opportunity for the what's remaining of the U.S. shipping industry. But what's ironic about it is I see large Chinese vessels come into the port of Charleston every single day. Clearly, we don't have an issue with them so much that we would ban them entirely. But there is this sort of strange impulse in the present administration that we have to have some of the fleet be American, where clearly American consumers don't seem to mind that the carriers would be Chinese or Korean or whatever. So it, to the extent it's a problem, it's a problem for my pocket.
I think consumers are the persons to be considered last in trade policy and trade politics. Yeah. I think we agree. You can agree on that.
That's absolutely right.
So the Chinese situation is a bit dire, but they have outside options. And I mean, and when we look at what happened in other fields, for instance, the retreat of US aid, this gives China quite an angle to engage with these countries. Do you already see engagement and increased activities of Chinese actors in developing countries?
Well, it's hard to say if there is an increase. I wouldn't be surprised, but it's quite a recent phenomena that USAID operations have been significantly cut. But it is interesting. The best data I have on this is from the wonderful aid data think tank in the U.S. at William & Mary College. And they interviewed leaders from 129 countries that are Belt and Road participants to get their perceptions. Interestingly, 40% of these leaders didn't know if their countries were Belt and Road participants or not. Some of them had a faint idea of, I've heard of that, I'm not sure, I see Chinese firms a little bit, but does that mean we're Belt and Road or not? But there's very heterogeneous views on this. So to the extent of like 40% or 35% regarded China as like the favorable partner for like large-scale infrastructure sort of projects, there was a clear recognition of the trade-offs involved. Like, yes, we can get these projects going more rapidly than other development partners, but that perhaps we're inviting worse labor standards, we're inviting domestic unrest because local people want those jobs, and China typically deploys their own state-owned enterprises to do this, and increased corruption possibilities. From this report, where it was a much more positive view was, say, in like China's handling of sending resources for COVID response. There was a quite favorable view of their interventions in this case. And it kind of makes sense to the extent that that's like an input-output problem. Here's the masks or whatever to solve this issue. Here are the masks. Oh, the people have them. They wouldn't have otherwise. It's a much cleaner problem to solve relative to helping to bolster economic growth in one's country, right? So it was quite a positive view from people in these countries to that extent. And I bring that up so as to say, to the extent that China can fill those sorts of areas that USAID activities previously were engaged in, then perhaps it's a benefit for them as far as the perceptions go, which is already, along that margin at least, quite positive.
We did a study some years ago on Chinese development aid in Latin America and the consequences for the perception on democracy. And the interesting thing was Chinese engagement didn't reduce the positive attitude towards democracy in Latin America, whereas U.S. aid would do, interestingly.
That's your paper.
Yeah, that was Latin America, but not Africa. But I also heard a lot about the Chinese companies hiring only Chinese people. But of course, if the U.S. is retreating and you see the gaps, if there's a sudden stop to finance a hospital, you see this immediately.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas, say, a program for increasing literacy in the longer run, that is not seen immediately.
Exactly, yeah, that's more ethereal.
And I was wondering whether Chinese actors are already coming to the rescue, so to speak. And imagine the U.S. really sticks to this and retreats from developing country. Will the BLR become more important again? And will the Chinese get it better funded again?
Yeah, I think that this retreat does present an opportunity for them along quite specific margins that we're sort of discussing to insert themselves. And we've noticed over the last probably 5 or 6 years, a movement away from the large scale projects that were characteristic of the press about the Belt and Road Initiative since its inception. For instance, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which sort of is the crown jewel, or was supposed to be at least. And that has more or less not come to fruition, at least along the way it was described, trying to make the coast of Pakistan sort of like China's California in some sense, right? And to have consistent trade going up from Gwadar through Islamabad up through Xinjiang, that is not happening. The Chinese wanted 500,000 professionals in the port of Gwadar by 2023. I think there is less than 1,000, and protests and armed groups at the gates of that port, right? You can't just make trade happen. But what you can make happen is, oh, well, the U.S. has cut off aid to this quite specific, like you mentioned earlier, some medical operation. That's an input-output problem, that we can supply the resources. Here are the resources to produce this thing. And I would be surprised if they're not already engaged in that effort. And so perhaps you've heard of the PEPFAR program. That's the U.S. president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, which was launched, I believe, under President Bush. And that was about to be slashed. I believe that was retained. But if something like that was slashed from USAID, then certainly there would be an obvious opportunity for China to fill that void at fairly low marginal cost compared to these grand infrastructure projects. So there's certainly an opportunity along those lines. Is that your view as well?
Yes, I think that's something I could imagine. And this is, you mentioned the word silver plate before, and I think that is another silver plate offered to the Chinese government. Currently, the U.S. seems to abandon its engagement in multilateral contexts. So the U.S. Government, I think, has stopped the payments to the WTO. They left the World Health Organization. They left Paris again. Does this offer China the chance to suggest themselves as the real proponents of multilateral trade, for instance? I mean, we know that China is under heavy criticism because of the state-owned enterprises and the habit to subsidize these. Little digression, we Europeans and you Americans also subsidize their business quite substantially, but nevertheless, it's not in the systematic manner that China seems to do it.
Sure.
But here is an opportunity. Do you really think that this opportunity is a serious one, or is it just the fear we might have?
Well, I think that it is feel somewhere in between those two, really, because I mean, really, the point that comes to mind is, you know, despite all the bluster in the U.S. context, yeah, certainly people that complain talk about the subsidies and the like. Of course, from the consumer angle, we're like, well, thank you for subsidizing us. We appreciate it. But of course, some competitors don't appreciate that. But it rather suggests that despite the complaints about, you know, the subsidies and perhaps some intellectual property theft from firms that are operating in China, despite all of that, China is perhaps in some way an underrated player in terms of upholding norms, like to the extent that we're engaging in these quite like large about face turns that cause tremendous uncertainty and are affecting the calculation of millions of people around the world with respect to their medium and long-term, short-term plans. China appears as a relatively decent option, comes out looking quite good relative to our topsy-turvy and chaotic path. Now, I'm not sure that will amount to an incredible windfall for them relative to what they're already engaged in these contexts.
But that's a very balanced perspective, which seems reasonable to me. What I was wondering is how China is now placing themselves, say, between, say, in this in systemic battle between the West and the rest, which seemed to be quite popping up again in the last years. So China, Russia, Iran as one part against the West. Now we have a president who expresses a deep scorn against this Western alliance. Is it an opportunity for China to join forces with the autocracies, or is it a threat for a global imbalance, which also might endanger Chinese business cases and also their preference for a stable order? What do you think? Are they happy with the scorn of President Trump, or do they think they need a strong counterpart in the West?
Yeah, I believe it is both of those things. On the one hand, our chaotic approach, I think, quite serves their political ends, such that they respond to our tariffs by beating their chests and engaging in some sort of response, whether that's increased subsidies to their state-owned enterprises or reciprocal tariffs or something like that. So to the extent there's that bluster, I think it quite serves them in terms of increasing the legitimacy of the CCP insofar as citizens like to see their own governments stand up to the governments of others, regardless of the efficacy of those policies. But the other side of that is, yeah, to the extent there's considerable uncertainty, especially in international trade, I think the figure after our, again, so-called Liberation Day tariffs were implemented, I think there is like 60% less freight that's originating from China in terms of maritime freight that's coming to the West Coast of the United States compared to previous levels. So, of course, yeah, that's going to have an effect here, but that's going to make some folks in China unhappy also, right? So there's sort of this balance of, all right, so we can increase our political capital by engaging in this beating of chests, so to speak, but what are the economic costs of that rather than bargaining in some way? So I think that is an important piece to balance. And yeah, to the extent that there, I think President Xi was in Moscow recently, you notice that that is a rather low-cost way of engagement. And to the extent you see what appears like increasing partnership with Russia or Iran, I don't believe that's because they value those partners like in and of themselves, but rather as like a what appears to balance like U.S. hegemonic power. I was in Cuba last year, and we were talking to some entrepreneurs there, which is a new class of individual. And they said, yeah, the Chinese don't deal with us at all. They want certainty. Iran doesn't present a very attractive option for them in terms of engaging in like strategic partnership, perhaps except for this, let's balance U.S. power, at least is my view on that.
I think we can agree that a return to the multilateral days of, say, 2002, 2005 is quite unrealistic. But is it? Do you think that this there is a chance that the US will retreat from their tariffs, that China will also retreat a bit from their tariffs so that they agree on a deal. What would be your suggestion or your expectation for the, say, the end of the year? Are we still in this turmoil with respect to China?
Yeah, I don't have much hope in the short run to this effect. Even though the president has somewhat retreated from the initial Liberation Day reciprocal tariff rates, which were completely insane. If you look at the poster he was holding up, the equation to calculate those rates was reflective of no meaningful economic reality that I'm aware of, but nonetheless. And then it was taken down to 10% across the board and then 145% on China. So, as you mentioned, the favorability ratings have decreased. And to the extent that that continues to occur, I think that is our best hope. For a while, it seemed the president was incorrigible to those. It's rather, we're going to pursue this policy regardless of what the public believes. But that has seemed to change to some degree. But insofar as he is so strongly endorsed, it almost seems like he believes in tariffs rather than as like a means to an end, which is, again, dubious itself to my mind, but just as a unmitigated good themselves. To the extent he believes that and has surrounded himself with folks of a similar view, it is hard to imagine there being a very significant about face, and that would rather have to wait for the next administration. And at least on that front, it appears that Democratic voters all of a sudden really love free trade, which I quite appreciate as an economist. All of a sudden, a few months ago, maybe they were somewhat questionable on it. But there's a popular podcast called Econ Talk here, and the host brought up in an episode that Milton Friedman, who was a guest on the podcast some 20 years ago before he passed away, they were commenting that, well, it appears when they were in the mid 2000s, they were discussing that, man, perhaps economists have won this battle for ideas, that people take trade as free trade on net as a quite positive thing. And Friedman said, no, I don't think the economists did this. It's that there was a generation of people who lived through price controls and did not appreciate that experience, and they lived through it themselves. So perhaps a silver lining of this is people experience disruption and they see that these ideas don't yield a benefit to their life, but rather a hindrance and a cost, and doesn't further their ends at all.
I think that's a very interesting and partly optimistic note on which we end here. And I can confirm that in Germany, social democratic voters are now also in favor of less tariffs rather than more tariffs because of the American tariffs. So it is a quite sobering experience. And thank you very much, Greg. It was a pleasure to talk.
It was a great pleasure speaking with you, Andreas, and I look forward to chatting again.
That's Why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany, sponsored by the German Federal Ministry of Research, Technology and Space.